From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Coming up this week, a public corruption commission holds its first series of hearings. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his thoughts on the New York City mayoral race, and we'll tell you about a question that's to appear before New Yorkers this fall on the statewide ballot. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. A commission appointed by Governor Cuomo to investigate public corruption is holding its first series of hearings. At the kickoff event in New York City this week, a prominent figure in busting corruption in the legislature announced he's found a backdoor way to confiscating the pensions of convicted state politicians. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
Co-chair of the Moreland Act Commission, William Fitzpatrick, who's also the Onondaga County DA, summed up the mood in his opening remarks at the first hearing.
You might think that if you ran a business where 35 of your employees in a five-year period were indicted, convicted, or investigated and let out in handcuffs, that this might invite a period of reflection on your part, a period of self-examination. Something along the lines of one business partner saying to the other, "Who the hell are we hiring here?"
U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, who uncovered several instances of corruption in the legislature this spring, including the separate bribery and embezzlement cases of former Senate leaders Malcolm Smith and John Sampson, was the first witness to testify.
Public corruption, based on all the evidence, appears rampant. And the ranks of those convicted in office have swelled to absolutely unacceptable levels. We've had to prosecute state senators as well as state assemblymen, elected officials, as well as party leaders, city council members, as well as town mayors, Democrats, as well as Republicans. In an age often decried for increasingly bitter partisanship, we can say that public corruption in New York is truly a bipartisan affair.
Bharara announced that he's found a way to seize the pensions of any public officials that are convicted of corruption-related crimes. He says he's already filed papers in two of the cases he's prosecuting. He'll require the politicians, if convicted, forfeit the amount of money that they would receive in the future in taxpayer-funded retirement benefits.
Convicted politicians should not grow old, comfortably cushioned by a pension paid for by the very people they betrayed in office. So my office has adopted a new set of policies. First, going forward, we will seek appropriate fines that take into account the money a corrupt official might derive from a publicly funded pension so that the punishment fits the crime and so that we can take the profit out of that crime.
Some legislators have proposed enacting a law to take away the pensions of convicted lawmakers, but the state's constitution prohibits it. In order to change the constitution, it would require the approval of two consecutively elected state legislatures and then go before the voters. That process could take years. The commission, charged with probing corruption in campaign financing, is already looking through the records of campaign donations held at the State Board of Elections. It's also sent letters to state lawmakers, who are also attorneys, asking them to disclose the names of all their clients they've represented in public, civil, or criminal cases, and the amount of money they received in legal fees. Partly as a result of those letters, all of the main factions of the legislature have hired private attorneys from prominent law firms. Republicans in the Senate have even hired a former U.S. attorney, Bharara's predecessor, Michael Garcia. Susan Lerner with the government reform group Common Cause says she finds that disappointing.
It raises questions. What are the legislators trying to hide? What are they so frightened of? When you have an entire legislative body that seems to be very dedicated to secretive behavior, even if they have nothing to hide, it just looks bad.
Common Cause is among the groups scheduled to testify at the next public hearing of the Moreland Act Commission to be held September 24th. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Alan, this week, this is what U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara had to say in front of the ethics panel. Corruption is rampant in New York State. And Bharara says the ranks of convicted office holders have swelled to unacceptable levels, and there's been talk of ripping away the pensions of convicted lawmakers.
Well, this is a tough one. I mean, if you really want to stop people from stealing, the consequences of doing it have to be very high. And one of the suggestions that he has made, my doubt is that the legislature will go along with it, but you never know. If they get under enough pressure, they may have to. And that is that if you catch somebody stealing or breaking the law, that you take their lifelong pension away from them on the theory that they're supposed to be serving the public interest. If they're ripping off the public interest, don't reward them for it. Now, whether or not somebody, some of the accused legislators who are now before the dock of the law, would not have done it had they understood that the consequences were greater than just going to jail, but, you know, depriving them and their families for the rest of their lives of any money to live on, whether or not they would have just said, okay, inner conscience, we can't do this because it's too great a risk. Who knows? I think the public will like it. I'm sure that someday Bharara, who's been a favorite of the public, is going to run for a political office. It's the kind of thing that one does. I can't really make an intellectual argument against it. I really can't. You know, sometimes there's some guy, and here's what makes me nervous. I remember a couple of years back, some guy was fined a lot of money because he was talking to the contractor who was walking through, and you're not supposed to do that. And if that guy, his pension got taken away for the rest of his life, that would be really bad. And you know that they always find some little guy, you know, to hang by the toes. So, you know, on the one hand, if it's a state legislator or a lawyer or somebody who's supposed to know better, sure. But I don't have a lot of confidence that this administration or other administrations will do it even-handedly.
Let's turn to New York City. We have a mayoral race now. Your Democratic candidate is de Blasio, your Republican candidate, Lota. And there was a poll out this week, Alan. NBC New York, Wall Street Journal, Marist poll finds 65% of likely voters supporting de Blasio to 22% for Lota. Elsewhere, you were talking with the state GOP chairman, Ed Cox, this week. He thinks that number is going to change.
Yeah, well, Ed Cox is right about one thing. Nobody knows who Lota is yet. Lota's going to make an argument to the middle class, and that is going to be, hey, look, remember before Giuliani when people used to hit you over the head and when crime was rampant and when there were all these murders in New York City? Is that what you want to go back to? That's what he's going to say. I have a feeling, and remember that we haven't had a Democrat in 20 years in the mayoralty in New York. De Blasio, for his part, is making a strong argument that the middle class is being screwed, that the rich are getting richer, that the middle class is getting left behind, and it has had a resonance in the minds of many voters. But I have to tell you, I don't believe for a second that you'll ever hear the word poor in the rhetoric of de Blasio or any other Democrat, because the middle class always has a choice. They can choose those below them. They can choose those above them. In the past, they've been choosing those above them and saying our interest is common with them. Someday I'd like to be rich, and when I'm rich, I'd like to keep my taxes. I'd like to do this and that. But here comes de Blasio, and he's saying, let's tax more. Let's tax the rich more. It's dangerous because everybody aspires to be rich. And even if they're not, they often fool themselves and say, I'm going to be rich someday if my train comes in, if my ship comes in. All right. So will it be anything like the split we see now in the polls? No. I think what's going to happen is the Republicans are going to do better, that Lota will do better. But right now, it's a pretty large gulf between the two men. And one would think that de Blasio really is going to win.
Will casino gambling win out when New Yorkers vote in November? You also talked to Cox about this. Seems like the issue of casinos and business tend to fall along the lines of Republicans, but he seemed against it.
I think that what you're going to find is that Andrew Cuomo has an upstage strategy, and one of the parts of that strategy is that there will be casinos. Casinos will bring jobs. It will take places like, you know, the Neville and others, if they win the contract, that will do better. Now, it'll be good for the region. We have seen in nearby Massachusetts that in middle class and up neighborhoods like West Springfield, that the voters reject it. They say, we don't want this stuff. It's not good for our kids, not good for us. It leads to addiction. It hasn't really helped other communities where it's been in. So we reject it. Some other communities say yes. So I think New York is a much tougher. I think there are going to be a lot of people who are opposed to it. The Catholic Church is often opposed to these things. They do bingo on their own, but they are in philosophical position to say no on, for all of the reasons I just stated, on gambling. So it could pass. On the other hand, it could fail. Now, I know I haven't quite got the crystal ball in front of me, but I think there are a lot of people going to not like it.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartoff. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Advocates for middle and low-income families in New York are puzzled by the initiative in Congress to cut SNAP benefits. They want to save the food stamp program that keeps millions of Americans from going hungry. We get more on that story from the Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas.
The House will vote on a bill that would slash $40 billion from the SNAP program over a 10-year period. Advocates argue the cut would deny between 4 and 6 million people food stamps. The new legislation would also allow states to require SNAP recipients to work. Jim Wallace is a Christian writer and political activist. He is best known as the founder and editor of Sojourners magazine.
The politicians really are picking on our poorest people to cut federal spending. They're not going to where the money is. They're not going to the Pentagon budget. They're not going to even agricultural subsidies that were in the Farm Bill. They're not going to oil subsidies. They're going to the poorest people because they think that's politically safe. Well, the faith community is going to make that politically unsafe for politicians to pick on the poorest people.
Wallace thinks it hypocritical for those opposed to government spending to dole out millions in subsidies to farmers, yet make cuts to food stamps. Mark Dunlay with the Hunger Action Network agrees.
With hunger at record highs here in the United States and the Capital District, we hope that our Congress representatives, including Congressman Gibson, will vote against any further cuts to the SNAP program, including the pending loss of the economic stimulus. Some Congress members seem to forget that half the people on food stamps already have a job but don't make enough money to make ends meet. So supporting a raise in the minimum wage to $9 or $10 an hour would be very helpful. And if Congress members, such as House Republicans, were serious about trying to get people to work, we hope they will finally put some money into job creation.
Calls to Congressman Chris Gibson, a Republican from the Hudson Valley, were not returned. According to the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, the average SNAP recipient received about $133.41 a month, or about $4.45 a day, in fiscal year 2012. About 20% of those receiving SNAP have college degrees. 50,000 of those who receive SNAP assistance are veterans. Wallace says he considers those who want to cut food stamp benefits morally compromised. He recognizes the importance of reining in government spending as well.
I've got young kids. I don't want them stuck with major debt, massive debt, shackled by that. I don't want that. Reducing deficits are a moral issue, but how you do it is a moral issue too. So rather than going after where the money is, where the special interests make sure their money keeps coming, we're going after poor families and kids, those who have no clout, those who don't make donations, those who are vulnerable. Well, for the faith community, our job, our major role, our priority in politics is to protect the most vulnerable. That's what we do. That's what God calls us to do. And we're going to do that here. The Circle of Protection includes the Catholic bishops, the National Association of Evangelicals, Sojourners, Bread for the World, Salvation Army, and we're going to make sure the politicians know that if they pick on the poorest people to cut their deficits, we'll say that's wrong, that's immoral, it's hypocrisy.
And there's a cut coming soon for every SNAP household on November 1st. A one-time boost from 2009 stimulus spending expires. In one example, benefits for a family of three will be reduced by $29 a month.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
A national nonprofit consumer health organization is calling October 1st a milestone when more than 2.4 million New Yorkers may enroll in health coverage under the Affordable Care Act. Two congressional representatives say many are probably unaware of the financial help available. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn explains.
Families USA released an analysis Tuesday estimating that roughly 1.5 million of the about 2.4 million New Yorkers who may purchase private insurance on the health care exchange will be eligible for premium subsidies. The nonpartisan group found that an additional 900,000 New Yorkers would become eligible for Medicaid. Families USA Executive Director Ron Pollack held a teleconference call on the subject.
As we count down the days to October 1, it will be important that all New Yorkers and New Jerseyans learn about these breakthrough opportunities. For those that enroll for this help soon, they will quickly receive the peace of mind and security that comes with knowing that their families can get the health care they need when they need it.
Democratic New York Congresswoman Louise Slaughter, along with Democratic New Jersey Congressman Frank Pallone, joined the call. She praised the Affordable Care Act overall.
We did not go into this because we wanted to aggravate the United States. It had to do with the cost of GDP of health care. None of us intended to have rocks thrown through our district offices, as I did, or our families threatened.
Pollack says the new financial help through the Affordable Care Act becomes available for middle and moderate income individuals who do not have employer-sponsored health coverage. New Yorkers with the lowest incomes, those with incomes below 138% of the federal poverty level, will be eligible for health coverage through the newly expanded Medicaid program. Congresswoman Slaughter, who is the ranking minority member on the House Rules Committee, commented on how House Republicans have voted 41 times to repeal at least some aspect of Obamacare.
We are going to get it right this time because it is the law, and nobody's going to turn it back. It's simply not going to happen. It is somewhat embarrassing to see these attempts at it.
The 41st time focused on a rule the Federal Department of Health and Human Services issued over the summer that gives state-run health insurance exchanges some leeway in deciding who qualifies for federal subsidies. The House vote, namely from Republicans, sought to block this. They say a better verification process needs to be in place. Another study on the new health care exchanges from a separate nonprofit nonpartisan group was released Monday with different information. Dr. David Hoberg, who co-wrote the study for the National Center for Public Policy Research, says the subsidy structure generally applies to older, sicker people, and those healthier, younger people ages 18 to 34 are less likely to qualify even if they appear eligible.
You're going to have a lot more people who are going to be, especially young people, who are going to be paying the full price for the premiums on the exchanges, and I think that's going to make it less likely for them to go on the, participate in the exchanges. And in any insurance pool, if you don't have enough young, healthy people participating, rates go up, the pool becomes far more expensive to cover, and that just incentivizes less young and healthy people to join. What ends up happening, this phenomenon is called a death spiral.
His study, however, did not include New York.
If my study was kind of the general rule, New York would probably be the exception. The reason being that the premiums are much, much higher there for young people, and hence that increases the likelihood that they're going to get subsidies.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. A question will appear on the statewide ballot this fall asking New York voters to approve a land swap in the Adirondacks. More from the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley.
Nyco Minerals hopes to trade 1,500 acres for 200 acres of forest preserve land. The smaller parcel, known as Lot 8, is next to the company's wollastonite mine and would allow the company to continue retrieving the mineral for another decade, according to Nyco Environmental Health, Safety, and Quality Manager Mark Buckley, who led a tour of a portion of the lands.
That land borders both the Hurricane Mountain Wild Forest to the south and the Jay Mountain Wilderness area to the north. So that will also make access to those two state areas much easier accessible than it is now. The state land is basically inaccessible now because of ours and some other people's properties that blocks access.
Supporters note that the company is the second largest employer in Essex County, and retaining its jobs are crucial. The mining company says there is only 3 to 4 years of wollastonite ore remaining at the Lewis site. Buckley says the swap will open access to a new vein without having to reclaim the site twice.
There's probably 1 million tons there, which would give us about 8 years of reserves. And it's important that we do it now because we have the infrastructure to mine that now. If we don't get it now, this will all be reclaimed and we'd have to put another crusher in here, put more roads on here in an area that's already been reclaimed.
A number of environmental groups are opposed to the swap, including Protect the Adirondacks. Executive Director Peter Bauer cites 4 reasons the swap is a raw deal for the forest preserve.
It sets a terrible precedent. This would be the first time that forest preserve lands were made available in a land swap for solely a private commercial benefit. Secondly, the state is giving away 200 acres of old growth. NICO has been given dozens of permits for a new mine about 1.5 miles away, which is a richer quality of wollastonite than its existing mine. Lastly, the public doesn't know what it's getting.
The Adirondack Council, meanwhile, supports the land swap. Executive Director Willie Janeway says the proposal met specific criteria that protects the environment and meets community needs.
1,507 acres being added to the Adirondack Forest Preserve, 200 acres being mined and then being returned, provide significant, clear win for the environment, improved recreational access, more than 2 miles of stream protected, not previously protected. The land that would be mined is not old growth forest, but it was previously logged and then became a part of the state land almost accidentally. And at the same time as being a positive for the environment, the land swap helps retain and extend 100 to 150 jobs in the town of Lewis and Willsboro, keeping those communities vibrant.
The question will appear as Proposition 5 on New York's ballot this November. Audio from the NYCO tour is courtesy of Mountain Lake PBS.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1338. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time. For more news on New York State government and politics, for the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.